Okay, so why don't we get started here? So I presume you all went to the discussion section yesterday. So we switched the schedule for this week to accommodate my travel. And thank you for your patience. It's probably not going to happen for a while. So early part of the semester was just filled with travel. So what I'll do is take about 15 minutes, which is what we have, finish the discussion on CPU scheduling, get going on synchronization. Probably won't get to the end of all the slides today, so we'll continue that discussion tomorrow. Okay? So keep an eye out for another homework, because we are covering ground at a rapid clip here. And as soon as we are done with synchronization, your first real lab should be out. Okay, so that lab is going to focus on threads and synchronization. Okay, the two topics that we have covered most recently. Okay, so quick recap what we did last time. We started talking about CPU scheduling. Okay, this is basically the task that the kernel performs to decide which job meaning a process or a thread, gets to run on the processor next. Okay, so we looked at first come, first serve, looked at round robin, did shortest job first. Okay, so he said, and presumably you understand how each of these policies work. Only thing to keep in mind that I mentioned at the end of last class was shortest job first is optimal in terms of waiting time. It's a scheduling algorithm or a policy that provides the least possible waiting time of any scheduling algorithm. Okay, but it is also an infeasible policy because it requires you to know the length of the job while making that scheduling decision, something that the OS will not know, something that typically even users don't know and cannot specify to the OS. Okay? So that doesn't quite work. So now we look at another policy called multi-level feedback queue, MLFQ. Okay? This is the policy that will try to approximate shortest job first. Okay? The shortest job first has a good property, which is minimal wait times. So you want to try to achieve that property, but you want to get away from the limitation of specifying job lengths and so on. Somehow you don't want to do that, yet you want the good property that shortest job first has. Okay? So first we want to overcome the prediction problem in shortest job first. Okay? The second thing we want to do, something that I actually didn't mention last time, is distinguish between I/O bound and CPU bound jobs in the kernel and treat them differently from a scheduling standpoint. Okay, so now to understand how we would distinguish and so on, we need to understand how these two types of jobs behave. Typically, given any job, you can either say it's CPU bound, which means it's spending most of its time doing I/O, or you say it's I/O if it's CPU bound, it's spending most of its time doing computation, very little doing I/O, or if it's I/O bound, it's spending most of its time doing I/O, and between any two I/O requests, there are short bursts of computation. Okay, is the difference clear? What's a CPU bound job? It's one that does mostly computation. I/O bound job is one that does mostly I/O. Okay, so now try to think about how the CPU scheduler should distinguish. If it doesn't distinguish, then all jobs are treated identically. Okay, as in round robin, they'll all join a queue, they'll be serviced in round robin order. There is no discrimination. Okay, everybody gets the same treatment regardless of what type of job. So we are trying to say, ask the question, whether it is appropriate to discriminate between the two and treat them differently. Okay, so to understand that, let's say, what would you want to do to an I/O? So how would you treat them differently? You would either favor I/O bound jobs or you will favor CPU bound jobs. That's the two things you can do. That's how you distinguish. You don't favor any, everybody is treated equally. Okay? So let's ask, why should we try to favor one job type over the other? Okay. So to understand that, think about what an I/O bound job does. Okay. An I/O bound job spends most of its time doing I/O, by definition. Okay. Meaning it is going to sit in the wait queue, it's waiting for the disk or some other I/O device to finish a slow request. Okay. Whenever the I/O request, the current outstanding I/O request finishes, the job becomes ready to run again. It goes to the ready queue. Okay. After it gets scheduled, it runs for a relatively short period of time and goes back to doing I/O. By definition, that's what it does. Right? So, right? So I/O bound job basically looks like this. do lot of IO, short amount of CPU, again lot of IO, short amount of CPU, and so on. Okay, this pattern will repeat. So most of its time over its lifetime it will spend doing IO, short periods are basically compute oriented. So now the question is, how do you treat this job when you compare it to a CPU bound job, which is basically just spending all of its time on the CPU? Any thoughts on this?
What do you mean by compare?
Would you want to treat this, would you want to favor IO bound jobs or not favor them? Meaning sort of, yes.
You want to favor IO bound jobs since they use less CPU. In theory they should run more or less immediately go IO, and then you can let the CPU jobs do their thing until the IO bound job needs to do
whatever. So suggestion being made is, let's favor IO bound jobs over CPU bound ones. Reason being, they are doing short amounts of CPU. Let them finish their CPU, go back to doing IO, and then the CPU is available to run your CPU bound jobs. Okay? That's one suggestion. Another way to think about this is, if you look at the length of the CPU burst of an IO bound job, it's small. Okay? So take a CPU bound job, it's basically doing long chunks of CPU computation. Maybe sometimes it does IO, sometimes it may not do any IO, and so on. So if you think about this from the shortest job perspective, okay, what we are basically saying is the length of CPU burst in an IO bound job is very small. Okay? So if you employed something that was similar to the SJF policy, you would basically pick this job over that job. That's all SJF would do. If it knew that this is the length of the CPU time that this job needs and this is the length of CPU time this job needs, so it will basically pick this job by definition of shortest job first. Okay? So if you want to approximate shortest job first, the simplest thing to do is to always favor IO bound jobs over CPU bound jobs. Because IO bound jobs have small CPU bursts. Okay? So that's, think of it as small CPU jobs, yeah, small CPU tasks interspersed by long periods of IO. Okay, the other way to think about it is what was mentioned here. So this job requires a long time on the CPU. Here's a small job, a job that requires very little CPU. Why not just give it the CPU and it will go back to doing its long IO, then you can run this without any interruption. Okay, so that way the IO bound job is happy, CPU bound job still gets its CPU. Okay, so one thing that you want to do is basically try to favor an IO bound job in order to approximate SJF. Okay? Now, when you submit a job, you are not actually labeling a job CPU bound or IO bound. Just as in SJF, you never actually told the OS saying this is the length of the job. Okay, so we will assume that to be practical, you are not expecting the user to tell the kernel saying this is the type of the job, hence you should favor it or not. You want the kernel to figure all this out automatically. Okay, so no specified information. OS needs to figure out what's a CPU bound job, OS needs to figure out what's an IO bound job, it needs to figure out how to treat them differently, figure out how to give this priority or favor these kinds of jobs over these kinds of jobs, and so on. Okay? If you manage to do that, you have a practical CPU scheduling policy that approximates shortest job first and yet gives you some good properties as far as overall behavior is concerned. Okay, so the fundamental observation we will use in MLFQ, okay, is that the past behavior of a job is a good predictor of its behavior in the near future. Okay, we'll say past is a predictor of the future. If a job has been doing a lot of computation in the near past, we will assume that it is likely to do the same in the near future. If the job has been doing a lot of IO in the near past, it will assume it is likely to do that in the near future. This is an assumption, it's not a guarantee. Okay? There is no guarantee that a job that was basically doing a lot of computation will actually in fact do computation. It might start writing a whole bunch of output to a file and start doing IO. Okay? So it's just an assumption that works well most of the time, but it's not a guarantee that that's what is going to happen in the future. You can't really predict the future. But we will look at the past and assume that the future looks like the recent past. The near future looks like the recent past. If that assumption holds, which it does in most cases, then that's a good bet. Okay, yes, question.
Does it predict by like the last one that comes out or the overall?
Okay. So how does it predict? That's a good question. I haven't said how do you do that. That is what MLFQ policy is all about. How are you actually going to do this prediction? How do you do this without any user input? So just wait until the next slide. It will all become clear. These are just the concept. Okay. So key concept are HJF is good in terms of waiting time, not practical. We want to try to approximate it, overcome its limitation. And how do we approximate it? We will try to favor IO bound jobs. IO bound jobs are like short jobs. Okay, because they spend lots of time doing IO. So let's favor IO bound jobs. That's an approximation of SJF. Okay, and then what you also want to do is figure out automatically which jobs are IO bound, which jobs are CPU bound. The way we'll do it is by looking at what a job did in the recent past. If it spent most of its time on the CPU, with very little IO, we'll label it CPU bound. Spend most of its time doing IO, we'll label it IO bound and assume that that's what it's going to do. Okay, job behavior can change over time and we want the policy to figure that out and adapt. Okay, so the last policy thing is as job behavior changes, as CPU bound jobs start doing IO or IO bound jobs go back to doing computation, you want the policy to adapt automatically. Okay, so let's now try to understand how this policy is going to do all of this. Okay, it's a long list of properties we want. The question is, how do we do it? Okay, so I'm going to draw some figures and illustrate. The same figure is here. Okay, so we'll assume that this policy maintained not one queue. Round robin maintained one ready queue. Here, we'll assume that the policy has multiple queues. Okay, I'm just going to dot three. Can have arbitrary number of queues. Okay. And so these are priority queues. Okay, the top level queue has the highest priority. The next level queue is the next highest priority. The next queue is the next priority. That is the priority. Okay. So here is how this scheduling policy works. Whenever a new job comes into the system, we know nothing about it. It hasn't run before, so we will by default put it in the highest priority queue. Okay, new jobs always start at the highest priority. Okay. The way this scheduler works is it's a simple priority scheduler. It basically always, when it has to pick the next job to run, it always starts at the highest queue. If there is a job there, it runs it. Okay. If that queue is empty, it goes to the next highest priority queue and says, is there a job that's waiting in that queue? Okay. If so, it will pick that job. Okay. If both of these queues are empty, it will go to the third level queue. Okay. So it will find the first highest priority non-empty queue. Okay, it'll start from the top and scan each queue. The first queue that is non-empty, okay, it'll pick a job from there and run. Okay. So by definition, what has happened is you'll always pick, if there are multiple jobs in different queues, you'll always pick a higher priority job over a lower priority job. So in this particular case, A will always be chosen over B because A is in the higher priority queue. This is what a priority scheduler does. Okay. It assigns priorities to jobs. And if multiple jobs are waiting, it picks one with a higher priority or one with a lower priority. Okay. Within each queue, you do round robin. Okay, if there are two jobs here, let's say A and B, okay, you will basically just do round robin. A gets to run and then B gets to run. If A continues to be in this queue, A gets to run again, and then B gets to run if it continues to be in. So you'll do round robin within a queue. Okay, if this queue becomes empty, and as I said, you'll pick the next highest queue that is non-empty. So if there are two jobs here, then you will do round robin here. Okay, and so long as this queue remains empty. That's how any priority scheduler works. That's how MLFQ also works. Okay, the first point is multiple queues do priority scheduling between queues. Okay, so far so good. Any questions? Okay, we are not done. There are several other things we need to do to get full MLFQ.
Yeah, yes.
How do the jobs get assigned a priority? So that's part I have not said at all. I haven't said where you go. I've just said the newest jobs arrive at the first. So that's the interesting part of MLF. But to understand that, first we need to understand priority scheduling, which is basically we used to always start at the top, pick the first non-empty queue going top down, and pick the job at the head of that queue. That's what priority scheduling. Okay? Now that's the important question is, how are jobs assigned to priority levels, etc. Okay, so this is where MLFQ does its more interesting bit. Okay, so here is how it works. Okay, I'm going to redraw this. Okay, so let's take job A. Okay, let's assume that it's a CPU bound job. The scheduler doesn't know that, OS doesn't know anything about this job. Okay? All that we know is a new job arrived, it has joined the highest priority queue. Okay? So and since there's, let's say that's the only job in the system for now, it will be chosen for execution. Okay? So it will basically run on the CPU. Okay, for its time slice. Because it's a CPU bound job, let's assume it does no I/O whatsoever. It will only do CPU computations. Okay? So it will basically be taken from here, it will run on the CPU. Okay? And for a certain time slice. So what MLFQ does is that if a job actually runs through its entire time slice without blocking, without doing I/O, takes its whole time slice and gets context switched, it will reduce the priority of the job by one. In this case, if A ran on its on the CPU for its entire time slot, okay, which it will because it's a CPU bound job, then the next time around it doesn't get to join this queue, okay, it will basically be dropped one level. Okay, it is basically its priority has been decreased. Okay, and so on. So now let's say since this is the only job in the system, scheduler will run again, it will look at this queue. It's empty, there's nothing to do. It will go and look at this queue, it's non-empty. So it will pick the job at the head of the queue, which again happens to be A. Okay, so A again gets to run on the CPU. Okay? And it will do the same thing. It will give it a time slot, and if it uses that time slot, you will drop one more level. Okay, in this case, a CPU bound job will use its time slot. So it will basically end up, the next time around, it will basically go here. Okay? So first thing that you do is whenever a job finishes its time slot without blocking, you drop it one level. The converse is also true. If a job does I/O in the midst of its time slot, which means it doesn't use its whole time slot, it basically starts doing I/O, you go up one level. Okay, so if you use your time slot, you are dropped. If you don't use your time slot, which means you do I/O in the midst of your time slot, you are bumped up a level. Okay, is that clear what I said? Yes or no? Yeah. Only two answers. Okay. Makes sense. Okay. So now, let me, if it makes sense, so let's ask the following question. If there is a mix of CPU-bound jobs and I/O-bound jobs, what happens to the CPU-bound jobs in terms of where they end up in these queues, and what happens to I/O-bound jobs? If the policy is what I just said, let's assume there are two jobs. Okay. One is a CPU-bound job, the other one is an I/O-bound job. Where does the CPU-bound job end up? Where does the I/O-bound job end up? Yes. CPU bound jobs always keep dropping. By definition, they always try use their time slot with high probability. So they will keep dropping and they will all end up at the lowest priority queue. Okay? Yes.
So when you say every time the process runs, is that every new instance of the process running?
No.
Or every time it goes?
Every time it is scheduled on the CPU. Okay, so let's assume the job is long, so it will need multiple time slots. Every time it runs, you observe what did it do. Did it use up the CPU or did it not use up the CPU? Only one of two things. I mean, did it use up the time slot or not use up the time slot? If it used it, you go one level down. If you did not use it, you go one level up.
All right, so this is for every instance.
Every time you run any job, you basically at the end of its time slot, you say, what did it do? Did it use its time slot? See where it was, put it one level down. Did it not? Move it up. If you are at the bottommost level, there is no more levels to drop, so you stay there. If you are at the highest level, there you can't rise any further, so you stay there if you don't use it. Okay? So CPU bound jobs all end up in the lowest priority queue. What happens to I/O bound jobs? I/O bound jobs will basically, regardless of where they are, once you start doing I/O, you will keep rising. Because every time you run, you will most likely not use up your time slot and just run for a short fraction of your time slot and start doing I/O. Okay? That will basically cause you to rise. So you will keep rising. So all the I/O bound jobs end up here. All the CPU bound jobs end up there. Okay? So now what have we done? This is higher priority, that's lower priority. So who are we favoring? We are favoring CPU I/O bound jobs over CPU bound jobs. That's exactly what I had said earlier, saying because I/O bound jobs do short bursts of CPU, you want to favor them over CPU bound jobs. This is automatically doing that by using this very simple policy, which says, look at what happened in the present time slot, and basically bump you up if you didn't use the time slot, or bump that job down if you use the time slot. And so you're basically differentiating between the job, even though you have no prior knowledge what type of job it was. Merely by looking at how it behaved in terms of using its time slot, you identified I/O bound jobs, you identified CPU bound jobs, and more. So you have actually differentiated between them by giving higher priority to I/O bound jobs or CPU bound jobs. Okay, so you have multiple jobs. Always you will start here. Okay, you will run these jobs. Okay, they will quickly run on the CPU and basically go back to doing I/O. This queue will quickly empty, and then you are free to go about running your CPU bound job, because there won't be much in the higher priority queues. All your CPU bound jobs are there, so you will continue to run them there. Okay, is that clear? The one other point that I didn't mention there is the time slices, or the length of the time slice that you give to each of this queue is not the same. Okay? As you go lower down, you give longer time slices, because you know that as you go lower down, is the job is more likely to be CPU bound, so run it for longer periods of time. Higher up, you know that the job is more likely to be I/O bound, so it's okay to give short slices, because even that short time slice is unlikely to be fully used. Okay? So that's the last point, which is the time slices are not the same. As you go further down, the length of the time slice doubles as you actually go one level down. Okay, so think of this as a 1 millisecond time slot, 2 milliseconds, 4 milliseconds, 8 milliseconds. You can have multiple levels. Okay, 16, 32, and so on. Okay, so any questions on this? So is it clear how this approximates shortest job first? Okay, so the way you approximate shortest job first is favor short jobs. Our definition of short jobs are I/O bound jobs, because they run for very short periods on the CPU, go back to doing I/O. Okay, so we are automatically favoring I/O bound jobs. So these are short jobs, these are our long jobs. Okay, so without knowing in the length of the job, we have started doing approximately what SJF would have done if it had that knowledge, which of course it doesn't. Okay, that's MLFQ. Let's do an example. Okay, so this is just the explanation. It says job starts in the highest priority queues. If the job's time slice expires before or it finishes its whole time slot, drop it one level. If it context switches before it's by doing I/O before it expires, you rise up. CPU bound jobs drop, I/O bound jobs stay at high priority. Okay, so now we will do an example, which says there are three jobs, 30, 20, and 10. Time slice is 1, context switch is 0, all jobs are CPU bound. Okay, this is an easy example. Okay, so all those three jobs with 30, 20, and 10 will start here. All new jobs start at the highest priority queue. Okay, so I can actually draw this here. Okay, so we'll say these are the three jobs. It's priority 1, 2, 3. Time slice is 1 millisecond, 2 millisecond. Okay, and this is 4 milliseconds. Okay, you will first run the job with, okay, I guess it started in the other order. So the 30 came first, and then the one with 20, and then one. So you first run this job. Okay, it runs for 1 millisecond. It uses its entire time slice. It's only CPU bound jobs here. Okay. So it will basically run for 1 millisecond and then it will be dropped one level. Okay. So it will go down here. There's 29 milliseconds of CPU time remaining. Okay. So it's used this one. So then priority scheduler, so you always start at the top. Okay. Still non-empty queue here. So you run this job. Again run for 1 millisecond. That's the length of the time slot. Uses its entire time slot. Okay, so you again drop it here. Okay, then you run that one. Okay, runs for 1 millisecond. See, it's CPU bound. So you go here. Okay, so now you again start at the top. This queue is empty. Nothing to do. So then you go to the next level queue. This is non-empty. So we'll run this job. Okay. This time we'll give it 2 milliseconds. The time slot at this level is 2 milliseconds. Again, it will use the entire time slot. It will run for 2 milliseconds and then you'll be dropped one more level. Okay, now you have 27 milliseconds to go. Okay, you run this one. Okay, it will again use up its time slice, run for 2 milliseconds. It will drop. Okay, then you'll run this one. Does the same thing. Okay, so all three CPU bound jobs are dropped to the lowest level. Okay, they still have some time to go. They are undone here. Okay, so now all these two queues are empty. They will stay empty for the rest of this exercise. So we'll keep cycling between these two. Now you do round robin. Okay, so you run this task. Now you give it 4 milliseconds. That's the time slot here. It uses its entire 4 milliseconds and still doesn't done any I.O. So it will basically go back to the end of the queue. It has 23 milliseconds to go. Okay, and you run that one. You run it for 4 milliseconds. Okay, so it's basically now going to require 13. So it will go back to the end of this queue. We'll run that one. Okay, it'll run for 4. It'll run for this 3 more milliseconds to go. We'll keep cycling. So after one more round, this job will be done. Okay, because it only has 3 milliseconds to go. It gets a time slot of 4. It will finish. Okay. And then you will do round robin between these two until they are both finished. Okay? Is that clear? So that's basically how MLFQ treated. Here is some notation that might help you sort of do this. Okay? So we here, in this notation, just to explain what's happening, is the same example. You have numbered the jobs 1, 2 and 3. 1 is this one, 2 is that one, and 3 is this one. Okay? So basically, the superscript here says how much CPU time you have received. The subscript is what's the current time in the system. Because at the end of this exercise, you have to basically specify what time did the jobs finish. What was the completion time of jobs, which is basically you have to enter that column and then you have to put the wait time. Okay, so you have to track how much computation it has done, what's the current time. Okay, so here it says it got 1 millisecond of CPU time, current time in the system is 1. And this one says it received 1, the clock has advanced to 2. Okay, and this one got 1 millisecond, clock has advanced to 3. Now all 3 are dropped here. Okay, so now each of them gets 2 more. So initially you had received 1 millisecond of CPU time. After the second time slot you have gotten 3. A clock advances to 7. Then you get this one also goes to 3, clock advances to 7. And then this is 3, this goes to 9, and so on and so forth. Okay, so it's the same example, but you are tracking how much CPU time a job has received in the superscript. You are tracking how the clock in the system has advanced in the subscript. Okay, when the superscript reaches the job length, that job is going to finish. And then that clock time is the completion time. Okay, because you say if this job receives 30 milliseconds, okay, that's the time, then that job is done. Okay, and then whatever the time is, that's what you enter here. Okay, that's how you would work through an example like this. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, so I will not draw the full example, but that's the solution for MLFQ. Okay, and it compares it with round robin. You know how to do round robin already. Okay, you'll see that the behavior is somewhat similar. If you take the average completion time, here is 48 and a third, here is 46 and 2/3. And then the wait time, you know how to compute, right? Okay, wait time is always the completion time minus the job length, assuming they all arrived at zero. If they arrived at non-zero times, you then also deduct the arrival time. Okay, so your 32 minus 10 gives you 22, 53 minus 20 gives you 33, and so on. Okay, so this, you should expect examples of this form in either homeworks or exams. Okay, this is an easy one. All the jobs are CPU bound. Okay, we could have just as well said one job does I.O., the other two are CPU bound. So in your example, you will find that the I.O. bound jobs keep dropping. The CPU bound jobs will probably stay at the higher priority queue. Okay, so there's an example here that does exactly that. Okay, I will not work through the full example, okay, but just explain how it works. Okay, here there are the same three jobs, okay, with lines 30, 20 and 10. The first two are CPU bound, okay, same as the previous example. The third one does I/O. After getting every 1 second of CPU time, it basically does 1 second of I/O. Okay, every time it runs for 1 second on the CPU, it will trigger an I/O request, and then it will basically do I/O for another second and then become ready to run again. Okay, then it will run for another 1 second at some subsequent point, do I/O, wait for another second and continue. Okay, is the problem clear? What is the scenario? Yes? No? Okay, so maybe you can work through this, and I will come back to the solution tomorrow. Okay, so it's the notes are there. The solution is actually there in the slides, but I encourage you to work through it so that you know how the thing works. But I will come back to the solution tomorrow just to give you a chance to see whether you understood. Okay, the reason I say this is MLFQ is actually the scheduler that most operating systems actually use in practice. Okay, so you don't have to write this. They are all in the notes. So you can just go to the class slides and then download this and work through it and see if you can figure it out. Okay, but I will, tomorrow at the beginning of tomorrow's class, I will go through the solution. Okay, so I will skip this and I will talk about fairness, and then we'll talk about one more scheduler, which is lottery scheduling. Okay. So there were two problems with the shortest job first. Okay, one was that it basically is not practical to implement because you don't know the job length. Okay, that problem we have solved by developing MLFQ, which doesn't need any job length information, yet it does similar things to shortest job first. Okay, the other problem with SJF, something that I did not mention last time but is very important, is that shortest job first can cause what is called starvation. Okay, and the reason is, if there's a mix of long and short jobs, let's call them L and S. Okay, not whether they're CPU bound or I/O bound, just take two types of jobs, a long job and a short job. Okay, you will, shortest job first always favors short jobs by definition. Okay, so if there's a steady stream of short jobs arriving into the system, your long job will not get any time to run on the CPU, because there is always a shorter job to pick and you will pick that job, and this long job is going to stay there and get starved, meaning it will not make any progress in the system. Okay, is that clear? So this is called starvation, which is basically a form of unfairness, because this job is not getting any CPU time. Other jobs are starving it out. They don't let it run because they always get picked over this other job. So whenever you try to favor some kind of jobs over the other, you want to make sure that fairness is not hindered. You don't want starvation to occur in the system. Okay? So these are the two limitations. One is SJF require job lengths to be specified, which you don't know. That problem we solved in MLFQ. The other problem is starvation. Okay? In SJF, which is short jobs always get picked over long jobs, so there are lots of short jobs perennially arriving in the system, your long jobs are basically in trouble. They don't run. Okay? Now, MLFQ actually does not address the second problem. Okay? It can also cause starvation. So, if you go back to this example, okay, so think about, so in this case, your CPU bound jobs will drop and go to the lowest priority queue. If you have lots of I/O bound jobs in the system, and some job always becomes ready to run and arrives in this queue, okay, you will always favor those I/O bound jobs over these lower priority jobs. Okay? And if you have lots and lots of I/O bound jobs, this queue will always be non-empty, because some job that was doing I/O has become ready, so it will basically arrive at this queue. So you will always, whenever you run the scheduler, you will always pick a job from here, and these jobs that have dropped will never get to run. Okay, same problem as shortest job first. You are basically favoring your short jobs, and these are precisely the I/O bound jobs that are here, the highest priority queues. Okay, is that clear what I just said? So MLFQ still has a starvation problem. If there are lots of I/O bound jobs, some of those jobs will become ready to run and always arrive at the high priority queue. This queue will always be non-empty. If this queue is non-empty, then you never get to service anything lower down. This is a problem in any priority scheduler. It's nothing to do with MLFQ. In any priority scheduler, if there's always a high priority job ready, the low priority jobs will never run. Because by definition, you always pick the high priority job, the low priority jobs get stuck. Okay. So this we have to address, otherwise MLFQ will basically not see good, you will not see good performance. Okay. If you run some background task that is doing computation and you have lots of interactive applications that are doing I/O, your background job will not run because you will always favor your interactive I/O bound jobs. Okay. The way this is done, the way Unix addresses this is by actually changing the priority of the job. What it does is something very simple. It basically says if some job in the system hasn't run for some period of time, you will basically move it back up. Okay, so your CPU bound jobs that drop, let's say this queue is always non-empty, here there are some jobs sitting waiting for CPU time. They wait for a period of time, let's say 60 seconds, just a number that I picked. So if a job hasn't run for a minute, okay, you will basically move it up. If it sits there another minute and doesn't run because this queue is empty, it will again move up. Okay? Even though this is not a I/O bound job, it gets to move just to get a chance at to run. Okay? So basically you will increase the priority of jobs that are starving until they get to run and then they will drop again. Okay? But at least it says that you get to run once in a while and it's not like you did not get to run at all. Okay? So this is essentially what. So this is an ad hoc solution. It prevents starvation by basically saying this job hasn't run for a while. Let's give it some CPU time. Okay, otherwise it will starve. So you just give it some CPU time. That's essentially what it does. Okay, this is something that most schedulers actually do in Unix, Linux, and so on. Okay, which is implement some MLFQ type algorithm. Okay, the number of priority levels may differ. The sizes of the time slices may differ, but this is essentially what they all do. Any questions on this? Okay, this is something that is important to keep in mind from a fairness perspective. Okay, one more scheduler, and then I'm sure we'll run out of time for synchronization, but let me finish this one. Okay, this is an interesting scheduler. Okay, it's called lottery scheduling. Okay, so this is the only scheduler that is randomized, okay, which means you will not be able to predict exactly what it does. All other schedulers you can tell what they do given some job length. This one is a randomized scheduler. Okay, this is how it works. Okay, you will have some number of jobs in the system. Okay, you give each job some number of lottery tickets. Okay, you can some integral number of lottery tickets. Could be 1, it could be 10, doesn't matter. Whatever it is, you give each job some number of tickets. Okay? Whenever the scheduler runs, it will take tickets from all the tasks, it will put it in a hat. Okay? It will run a lottery, it will pick one of those tickets. Okay? The ticket that wins, okay, you pick that job to run. Okay? So you pick a winning ticket, you see which job actually holds that ticket, and that's the job that will run. Okay? So every time you run a lottery, okay, the winner of the lottery is the one that will run. Okay, so let's now understand how this scheduler works. Okay, so we'll now start with very simple example. Two jobs A and B, okay, you give them each one lottery ticket. Okay, so they are competing. Every time the scheduler runs, it will take these two tickets and it will pick a winning ticket randomly. Okay. So half the time A will win the lottery, half the time B will win the lottery. They hold equal number of tickets, so the equal chance of winning the lottery. Okay, so approximately what's going to happen is over long periods of time, this job gets 50% of the time slots because it won the lottery half the time, and this one gets the other 50%. Okay, so that's fair. They basically share the CPU. Okay, so now let's take a simple other scenario. So let's assume this job gets two tickets. Okay, you assign job B two lottery tickets, A still has one. Okay, so what happens now? How, what, with what probability will A win its win the lottery? Sorry? 33.3, that's a third. Okay? And B will win the lottery 2/3 of the time. Okay, so basically you take, if you have a third of the tickets, you will win the lottery a third of the time. Okay, in the previous case, you won half the tickets in the system, so you go in the lottery half the time. Okay, the probability which way you win the ticket depends on how many tickets you have and the total number of tickets in the system. Okay, so basically, the chances of winning the lottery is this fraction. Okay, how many tickets do I own and the total number of tickets. In this case, you own one ticket, there are three in the system, so you will win the lottery 1/3 of the time. This one will win 2/3 of the time. Yes, your question. Yes, the tickets are never taken away. You have perennially given it two tickets. Every time you run the lottery, this one will drop two tickets in the hat, this one will drop one ticket. You pick a ticket out of these three. Okay, so it's not like once you win the lottery, that ticket goes away. This is how many tickets you have for every lottery that's run in the system. Okay, so what is this scheduler doing? It is allowing the user to specify how many tickets each job has. And if the user can control the number of tickets assigned to a job, it can control how much CPU time that job will receive in the system. Okay, so in particular, if you want to give more CPU time to a job, you give it more tickets. The more tickets a job has, the more likely it's going to be that it will win the lottery. The more you win the lottery, the more CPU time you get. Okay, so in particular, if you give this guy 9 tickets and this guy 1 ticket, you get 1/10 of the CPU time. Here it gets 9/10 of the CPU time, because you will win the lottery 90% of the time. This one will win the lottery 10% of the time. So you get 10% of the total time slots. This one gets 90% of the total time slots. Okay, so now you have basically given a lot more CPU time to this job or that job, and so on and so forth. Okay, so you can control the number of tickets assigned to a job. Okay, user specifies this, and then the system basically allocates CPU time or time slots in proportion to the number of lottery tickets a job owns. Okay, so this is always going, there's no starvation here. Okay, regardless, every job needs at least one ticket. Okay, so regardless of how many tickets there are, you will win the lottery every once in a while. The probability may be small, but it's non-zero. Okay, so you will always get some CPU time or some long periods of time, you will win the lottery. Okay, if you buy enough lottery tickets in your lifetime, you will win the lottery. But you have to really buy lots of tickets, because there are lots of tickets being sold. Okay, same is true here. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. Okay, you can basically mimic any kind of behavior. If you know a job is I/O bound, give it more tickets. Those jobs get favored. If you know a job is CPU bound, you can give it fewer tickets. Okay, so basically I/O bound jobs can get priority and so on. Okay. So here are some examples just to illustrate. Okay, your question. Okay. So we'll assume there are two types of jobs, long and short. Okay, just call them A and B, red or blue, doesn't matter. Okay, the CPU time will depend on tickets, not the type of the job. So if you give one ticket each, okay, and then short jobs always get 10 tickets, long job always gets one ticket. Okay, there's one short job and one long job. Okay, this one will get 91% of the CPU. Okay, it basically gets 10/11 of the total CPU time. Okay, the long job gets 1/11, because there are 11 tickets in the system. Okay, so if this one will win the lottery, the short job will win the lottery 10/11 of the time, and this one will win 1/11 of the time. Okay, that is the scenario. Okay, now we'll assume there are zero short jobs. There are no short jobs in the system. There are only long jobs, and there are two of them. Okay, so this column is meaningless. There are no short jobs, no CPU time being given here. So what's the percentage of the time each long job gets? There are two long jobs in the system. Okay, it should be 50%, because there are two long jobs. Each gets one ticket each. Okay, this is 1:1. Okay, so each will get half the CPU time. Okay, same is true here. Okay. Now there are two short jobs, no long jobs. Each gets 10 tickets. Okay. If there are two jobs that get 10 tickets each, that's the same as giving them one ticket. They have equal number of tickets, so they win the lottery with equal probability. Okay. So again, here the percentage of CPU time is 50% to each job. This one is not 0%, and no long jobs. Okay. These are slightly more involved. There are 10 short jobs, each get 10 tickets. There's one long job, each gets one ticket. Okay, which gets one ticket. Okay, so. Okay, one. Okay, so first you have to, this is your magic formula that tells you what is the chances of winning the lottery. Okay? My tickets over total tickets. Okay, first, how many tickets are there in the system? In this case. Arithmetic. 101. Okay. Okay, 10 times 10, 100 tickets here, 1 ticket there, 101 tickets total. How many tickets does a short job have? 10 tickets. That's the probability with which a short job will win the lottery. Okay? Basically doing 10 over 101. Okay? This is doing 1 over 101. Okay, so short jobs get approximately 10% of the CPU. Because they won, each short job wins the lottery approximately 10% of the time. Okay? Long job gets approximately 1% of the CPU. 1 over 101 is approximately 1%. Okay. So in this case, if this is how you assign the tickets and that's how many jobs there were, each short job will get approximately 10%. Each long job gets only 1%. Okay. Whether this is a good thing to do or not is not what the point is. Okay. That may be the wrong thing to do, in fact. But if you assign the tickets in this way, that's how the system will behave. That's how your jobs will receive CPU. Okay. This is doing the opposite. There is one short job, 10 long jobs. Okay, so how many tickets do we have now? 20 tickets. Okay, what's the probability of the short job winning the lottery? 10 over 20. Each one has, so my tickets is 10, total is 20. Okay, that's that. What's the probability of a long job winning the lottery? 5%. That's one ticket over. Okay. So that's how you need to work these through. Okay, so that's all the solutions that we work through. Okay, so lottery scheduler, remember that it's always a randomized scheduler. You can never guarantee which job will get to run next. We'll always decide this using a random lottery. But over long periods of time, okay, you basically can show that you'll get approximately some fraction of the CPU, because that's how many times you'll win the lottery. Okay, so I will stop here because we have run out of time. Okay, so do that exercise and come back tomorrow, and then tomorrow we'll start synchronization.
Are those all the different types of CPU scheduling schemes are?